Hi, I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
And I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're talking about breakfast for dinner, immersion circulators, and the cookbook Modern Potluck with author Kristen Donnelly. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. So, it's been really interesting to me to read all of these reports about how food from large events is getting reused and served to homeless populations. Did you see the article about how a chef in Reno is using leftover foods from the Olympics to feed?
I did. It was Massimo Bottura, who I believe was a chef profiled in Mind of the Chef.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, interesting guy. I did see that. I thought that it was sort of more of an awareness-raising effort on his part. It was like really upscale food,
yeah,
gourmet-type food, and obviously just for a short time. But it did bring attention to how much waste there is. There was literally tons of food left that was just going to be wasted if he didn't.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that there was a similar effort here in Philadelphia, not, you know, high-end upscale food to bring awareness to the issue. But during the Democratic National Convention, there was an app that people were using to donate leftover food to shelters and other populations to ensure that that food didn't go to waste. Mm-hmm.
And I remember when the Pope was here, a lot of the restaurants had been sort of groomed by the city to prepare for large crowds that never showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And informally, a lot of restaurants were donating, you know, behind the scenes to get rid of all of the extra inventory that they had purchased for that. But I find whenever there's a big event, there's always leftover food. You remember when Edible Philly put on the Eating Words conference in February? It's not like there was a lot of food there. It was just like breakfast, snacks, and lunch. And there was still kind of like a painful amount of stuff that was just thrown away.
Yeah, I remember.
I think it was just thrown away. Maybe the library donated it.
I put 3 bagels in my bag after the
Edible Philly. Oh, good for you.
After that conference. Well, it was the end of the day and there were leftover bagels and I figured, you know, we would eat them for breakfast the next day and we did.
But I mean, waste is not limited to the Olympics or other big major events like that. All kinds of little events leave in their wake tons of wasted food. And as we know, something like 40% of the food that we buy at the store gets wasted in your typical household.
True enough. It's a big issue. I remember when I was really involved with the Unitarian Church here in Philly, we would have events and then pack up food and take it to various shelters and actually have pre-arrangements with shelters to like say, hey, we're having an event tonight. We imagine we're going to have food left over for 15 or 20 and they would expect us. And it was a nice way to ensure that it didn't go to waste.
Yeah. The story about the Olympics, which was an Associated Press story, I think, that ran in all kinds of papers. It was just like that problem on an Olympic scale, you know.
Literally,
But it's got to be a good thing to make people more aware of it. I think that when you do a lot of home cooking, like you and I and probably many of our listeners do, you are more aware of it because you have like a real close hands-on relationship with food. But for lots of people, I still think it doesn't register at all.
It's true.
And anything that can be done to make people more thoughtful about it, I think is good.
Yeah, because we're heading into a world where we are not going to be able to waste the way we do now. Like, it's just becoming more and more problematic. So it is good to.
It was kind of interesting to see how many food stories were tied into the Olympics somehow or another. It's a lot of them.
Yeah, between what the athletes were eating and waste at the Olympics and, you know, who was providing food at the Olympics. There was a lot of.
I read several stories on just like, what so and such athlete eats in a day? Or look at this guy's 10 million calorie diet. Or
even the coverage, like, after the gymnasts were done competing, they were like, what are you going to eat?
Really?
You know, yeah, they were talking about like eating pizza and cupcakes because they hadn't been allowed to eat those foods during training.
I have to say, I didn't watch 1 minute of the Olympics.
Really?
Is it over now?
No, there's still some. Well,
I mean, it'll be over when this airs.
But right now it's still airing. Yeah, I've been watching pretty intently. I enjoy it.
That's great for people that are into it. I love it. Anyway, let's talk about what we're eating for dinner this week.
Sounds good.
Breakfast for dinner?
Yeah.
At least at your house.
At my house, we definitely fell back to breakfast for dinner this week. It is the height of canning season. I'm about to leave town for a few weeks of book touring. And so I have been canning a lot. And the one downside to doing a lot of canning is that you get to the end of the, you get to dinner time and you're like, oh, crud.
You guys,
I've been cooking all day.
If you could see the stuff in Marisa's place. I mean, I have seen Marisa can and preserve many, many things during the 10 yeah. years that we've been friends, or even more than that. But when I came in here today and saw her stash, I literally gasped at the amount.
Well, so part of it is, so I've canned 22 quarts of cucumber pickles this week because I went to buy.
How many hours would you estimate that takes you?
So it doesn't take me that long. And we'll talk more about the pickles later when we talk about immersion circulators, because that's my new.
I don't want to derail us.
No. But I would say that a batch of, like a 7 or 8 quart batch of pickles, I mean, I use a mandolin to slice them. So it's no more than like 10 minutes of active slicing. Pack the jars. I use sort of an assembly line system. So from start to finish, the active time is only half an hour.
But you've had all these canning projects. You are not really into cooking dinner, so breakfast for dinner.
So I was going to make soup this week, like a, you know, some sort of like, you know, eggplant and tomato kind of soup, and I just could not face it. Mm-hmm. And so there was some leftover roasted potatoes and broccoli in the refrigerator, and I was like, frittata for dinner. And so I did a frittata.
I don't really consider a frittata breakfast for dinner because I never eat frittata for breakfast.
Oh, see, I will. Like on a weekend,
For some reason.
But to me, it feels like, I feel like anytime you eat eggs for dinner, it is sort of a breakfast for dinner mm-hmm. situation. But last week we did literally just scrambled eggs and toast for dinner. So it's been as much a like life-saving measure mm-hmm. as a, you know, this is cute, let's have breakfast for dinner kind of thing.
Yeah, you're not talking about pancakes.
No, I'm talking about the easiest, fastest food that doesn't require making any more mess mm-hmm. and will satisfy the two, you know, Scott and me.
I definitely enjoy frittata for dinner. I can't say I eat scrambled eggs that much for dinner, but I could. That wouldn't make me feel depressed about dinner. But I couldn't do like pancakes or French toast or waffles. Or even, I don't know if I would be cool with like sunny side up eggs and toast.
Really?
I think that would make me feel, I mean, in an emergency, I guess, but I'd rather make like an omelet. When we put this on our list of things to discuss, I was thinking about, you know, Townsend Restaurant in South Philly.
Mm-hmm.
I was there recently and they added this new item to their menu. It's a mini French style omelet with crab and cream.
That sounds so good. Amazing.
I could eat that for dinner every night of the week. But again, it would be weird at breakfast to me. That's my kind of breakfast for dinner.
Yeah. No, I mean, mostly when I do breakfast for dinner, it definitely includes eggs of some kind. It's not
a lot of people do yeah. like the pancake thing. I don't even like pancakes in the morning.
Pancakes weirdly give me a headache. You know, it's like, I think it's all the like bready sugariness, like of the just, it's so much dough.
I read it somewhere that pancakes basically became popular during the Depression because people just didn't really have anything.
Yeah.
And it's really just such a meager recipe.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why when I was a kid, so my dad has this pancake recipe that he developed in the 70s when he was working at IHOP. And he was like, I can do better than this. He was a short order cook for a while. And so he spent my entire childhood sort of like refining and developing a pancake mix, which is, it's actually in my first cookbook, but it's like whole grains and wheat germ and millet and like the hippiest of hippie whole grain pancakes. And those are delicious, especially like sometimes I'll even add like nuts to them. So it's like all this whole grain and nuts and, you know, two and you feel full.
No headaches there.
No headaches there. But like a fluffy buttermilk pancake immediately gives me a headache.
Right. I don't know. Between pancakes for dinner and like a handful of cashews, I'd rather have a handful of cashews.
Yeah, I get that. So enough of breakfast for dinner. It's I think I enjoy it, but Joy's not too excited. Let's go on to talking about immersion circulators, because we teased this a minute ago about pickles. So here's my immersion circulator story. 2 years ago, the folks from Anova sent me one because they had pitched me. I said, oh, that's awesome. There's this really awesome pickling preserving technique called low temperature pasteurization, where you, instead of doing a boiling water bath canning process, you maintain a lower temperature for a longer time so that you don't cook the vegetable as much and you end up with something that still has some crunch. And so they sent it to me. I was in the middle of
What's the temperature that you need for that?
Between 180 and 185. Okay. So 180 is ideal, but on a stovetop, it's hard to maintain exactly 180, so you kind of waffle between.
And boiling is like 212, so that's a pretty significant difference.
Exactly. And so they sent me this immersion circulator, and I was in the middle of my book tour for Preserving by the Pint, and I did 113 events for that book. And so I put it in my closet, and thinking I'll get back to this soon. And fast forward 2 years later, I finally pulled it out. And now I'm kicking myself because it is amazing for making crispier, crunchy textured pickles. I am totally sold. I love it.
That's cool. I have one too, but I've never used it in that way.
Yeah.
I like it for, I especially like it for pork tenderloin and pork loin. Again, it keeps the water at a very steady temperature, so there's no risk of overcooking it, which is to me the worst thing you can do to a lean meat like pork.
Yeah.
And then you can just sear it at the end if you want, or, did we talk about this when we talked about tuna tonnato sauce?
I think you briefly did. Yeah.
That's how I prepared the pork that I used to go with that sauce. And I actually have plans to buy a salmon CSA almost exclusively so I can sous vide the salmon, because I think that would be a tremendously delicious way
Definitely.
To enjoy wild Alaskan salmon. But I haven't used it for, it's not like I spend a lot of time making preserves and jams. I do ferment, but I'm not a vinegar pickle maker so much. But maybe I will try it out that way. I love a crunchy cucumber pickle. Yeah.
And it's a game changer in terms of making crunchy pickles, because if you don't pickle, you might not know this, but the crunchy pickle is the holy grail. You know, it is really hard to get a cucumber pickle to retain its crunch after being preserved. And so for years I've been telling people, you know, you should make refrigerator pickles. Like, that's the only way to make a really crunchy cucumber pickle. But I feel like the immersion circulator is definitely a game changer.
And you have zero anxiety about food safety, even at that lower temperature?
No, because it is – there's also a lot of vinegar and salt in those jars. So in that much vinegar, nothing can really go bad anyway. You know, it's a one-to-one, one part vinegar, one part water in the brine. And so it's not like you won't have any sort of botulism issue ever in that much acid. Mm. It's simply like you could at some point have some sort of mold or yeast if, you know, you were, but that's on the outside. And I mean, not on the outside of the jar, but like it's the outside chance of that happening. Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, if you bring the water up to, even if you get it to 180, once you put the jars back in, it drops down about 20 degrees. So then you spend half an hour coming back up to temperature and then another half hour at 180 degrees. Nothing's going to survive that.
Have you done anything else with your immersion circulator?
No, I'm embarrassed that I have only used it for pickling, but I love it for pickling.
One thing I want to encourage you to try to use it for some other
I'm going to
projects. One thing that it works really well with is, you don't need the fancy equipment.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is like a sort of like a home sous vide situation, but it's not, for me at least, it's not sous vide because I don't put anything under vacuum. I just put the stuff that I want to cook in a zip top bag.
Yeah.
Get as much air out as I can and then proceed.
I really want to do eggs in it because I have always enjoyed at restaurants like that, you know, sort of soft boiled egg that is sort of cooked all the way through but still has a soft texture.
I haven't tried that, but I'd like to.
Yeah.
But really, like for meats that are, you worry about overcooking, it's terrific.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what else it does for my cooking. I actually, it was funny because I was playing with it this week and then another company got in touch and was like, hey, we have this other immersion circulator vacuum sealing thing, and they reached out to see if I'd want to do something, so they sent me their unit to try. And
wait,
so
now you have two?
It's insane. It's, you know, soon.
I don't know how you do it. You have so many tools.
I know, it's obscene, actually, how much cooking gear I have in my apartment.
That's one of the main reasons I want to move, so that I can grow my collection of cooking gear.
Me too, because right now my whole apartment is a kitchen, essentially.
Right. Well, you know, in my house, the kitchen is like definitely bleeding out into the living room.
No shame in that.
But I'm like on the verge of buying a second immersion blender, you know?
I fully encourage that, Joy. Why are you buying a second immersion blender?
Well, Dan, my ancient trusty KitchenAid immersion blender broke finally. And then Dan decided he was going to get like this high tech, top of the line version that's used in restaurant kitchens a lot. And it is very powerful. It's like the next most powerful thing in my kitchen after the Vitamix. But I like the immersion blender for making mayonnaise in a jar.
Oh.
And it's too powerful. The mayonnaise breaks every time.
Oh, no.
So it's like I can't use it for the one thing that I mostly use it for.
I highly recommend the OXO immersion blender.
I know you love that one.
I do have multiple immersion blenders myself, but the OXO is the one for like jar-based tasks and small things. It's really nice. And I love that the shaft is coated in, I think, silicone.
And it has a light.
Yeah, it's nice. I know.
I'm a little jealous. I'm going to get one too. Kristen Donnelly is a former food and wine editor, a writer and recipe developer, and now a cookbook author too. Her book, Modern Potluck, makes a case for cooking large and sharing with friends. She grew up in the Philly area and has recently moved to Bucks County, where she lives with her family. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us today.
I'm excited to be here.
We are both fans of your work and your book, and Marisa is a huge potluck aficionado, and I'm inspired to try to become one. I know that you mentioned that your daughter inspired the book in some ways. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So before my daughter was born, she's now 4 years old, I was a food editor and out to eat all the time. And when I wasn't out to eat, I was often entertaining friends and doing large, elaborate dinner parties. Maybe not large, but elaborate. And after she was born, first of all, couldn't go out to eat as much because it was way more expensive because I had to hire a babysitter. And the dinner parties, I mean, I could barely cook dinner day to day. So forget a dinner
party.
When
you say you used to have elaborate dinner parties, do you mean multi-course?
Multi-course and something where I would cook all day. You know, you go to the market and see what's fresh. And they often involve some kind of challenge. I'm trying to think back, but, you know, maybe making fresh pasta or that sort of thing.
Something that took up the whole day.
Exactly. And I enjoyed it. I really loved doing that.
Not necessarily compatible with being a new mom, though.
Not at all. And I felt like I didn't have a social life. I had switched from being in an office as an editor to being freelance, to working freelance. And I love that, and I love the flexibility. But, I didn't have coworkers to talk to, and I barely saw my friends. So it's like, how can I have my friends over, get together with friends, and make it easier? And there are many ways to cook a simpler dinner party, for sure. But I also thought about how my mom used to entertain, which was basically potlucks. And she never called them potlucks necessarily. It was just the way it was done.
I'm glad you bring up your mom, because mm-hmm. that brings me to the next question, which is, you also write about how your family's potlucks were a little bit different from what we might think of the stereotypical canned soup laden potlucks of the 80s and 90s. Can you say a little bit more about that? What kind of food did your family share?
Well, there definitely was some of that condensed soup casseroles, especially in the winter, and then dips made with like packaged seasoning. That was a common.
I actually still kind of love a dip like that.
I do too, actually. And then another common dish was something called a 7-layer salad. Mm-hmm. And I actually did do a version in my book that's updated. Oh. The classic tends to contain like bacon bits and shredded cheese, raw peas, or just like thawed frozen peas mm-hmm. often. Mm-hmm. And I did a version that's a little brighter.
So your family's potlucks were the typical potluck.
Often.
Yeah. But I thought I read that they sort of would change up their dishes that they were making every several years, or
I mean, every decade.
Every decade.
Yeah,
I guess that's not really much of a refresher.
It did. My mother actually tends to be more adventurous and will cook new things, but my extended family often will cook the same thing, especially for certain occasions. There will always be like German potato salad was mm-hmm. a dish. A pineapple stuffing lingered around.
Oh my God,
for
my
years.
Aunt made a pineapple stuffing in the 80s and 90s, which I actually really liked.
It's good with ham.
Very sweet.
It's very sweet.
I wonder if it's probably the same dish.
Yeah, probably. Ambrosia salad, I forgot. That had a long run
wow.
at a certain point.
Okay. So do you think that the potluck menu has, obviously, in your book, you're trying to change that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it has changed much, or do you think that the dishes have stayed the same, or do you just think it needs to change?
I think it often depends on the potluck. I get a Google alert for potlucks, and I will say there are often around the country vegan potlucks. It must just be because, you know, it's a group of people who maybe, like, don't can't necessarily find food they want to eat
right.
in restaurants.
It's probably hard to find a restaurant for that group.
Yeah. I think I even saw one called Vegan Support Group recently having a potluck. So it depends. And I recently went to a potluck. Joy mentioned we just moved to Bucks County, and I went to a potluck on a farm there, and that was all like fresh, beautiful produce, tons and tons of salad. So I think it has already shifted, and mm-hmm. then I'm also trying to shift it a little bit and make use of, number one, the global pantry that we now have access to, and number two, just a lot of these great fresh vegetables right. and more obscure vegetables that we didn't know about before.
I must say that the only potlucks I've ever been to have been baristas.
Oh, well, they're probably.
And they're usually very good.
Yeah.
But you mentioned the global pantry. Can you maybe tell us an example of a dish, like a modern global pot, that dish that you think that's in your book and will be perfect at a potluck?
Sure. So I did do a kale Caesar salad. Kale Caesar salad has been, you know, huge for the past 5 years, but I made the dressing by pureeing kimchi with the fermented Korean pickle that's garlicky and spicy with some mayonnaise and lemon juice. And I think because of the anchovy and the garlic along with the mayonnaise, it's this dead ringer for Caesar dressing, but mm-hmm. also has something a little extra. Mm-hmm. And then you get the healthiness of the kimchi as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that is an example where I feel like I bring that in.
I think that's a great example because it seems like you could, it's like adventurous, but not too adventurous.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe somebody wouldn't even know there was kimchi in it unless they asked.
Yeah. In the introduction, I talk about how I wanted to do dishes that are a little bit impressive. So it might cause people to go, ooh, what's that? But isn't necessarily too scary. And I tried to do things that were familiar. So, for example, instead of a lasagna, I did an enchilada pie. So it's tortillas mm-hmm. in place of the noodles, and then sort of like Southwestern inspired vegetable ragu and lots of cheese.
Cheese notwithstanding. You mentioned that the kale salad was pretty healthy, and yep. you've spent a lot of your career working on healthy food. How important was that healthiness factor in this book?
It was important in that I think that many of us aspire to eat healthier, in that we want to eat more vegetables, but I tried to put taste first. So there's still mayonnaise, there is still cheese. But if there was an opportunity to lighten something in, you know, a not creepy way, so not low-fat cheese, for example, I did do that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, fresh vegetables, as we mentioned, like are not a hallmark of potlucks past, maybe. And there's certainly many fresh vegetables and vegetable-focused dishes in your book.
Yes.
We actually featured it in Edible Philly, and one of the dishes we featured was inspired by Veg, mm-hmm. which is our terrific vegan restaurant here in Philadelphia. Did you find you yourself reaching for inspiration from restaurants a lot? Or
I did. Restaurants as well as just other cooks around the country. While I was an editor at Food & Wine, I worked with I don't even know how many other cooks. So I think I must have been like mentally filing away all these little, whether it was flavor combinations or techniques, and they come up in many of the recipes throughout the book, and I tend to credit them because I think it's more fun that way.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there is something I like when I make dinner myself, or if I go to dinner at someone else's house, or, you know, at a potluck, it seems fun to have it be a little restaurant-y. It makes it feel a little bit more special, I mm-hmm. guess. And it's sort of a hard thing to balance with the healthiness factor, as we mentioned, but I guess vegetables go a long way. Can you talk a little bit about that dish that was inspired by Veg?
Sure. So let me try and think back. Rich.
It's a Rich. Yes.
Rich. Yeah. He has
Rich Landau. He's the
Rich
chef.
Rich Landau is the chef. Veg. And he has a dish called carrot shawarma. And I remember we talked about it because preparing the carrots, I think he blanches and then roasts and then grills. And I think I ended up just roasting the mm-hmm. carrots, but it's in sort of this warm Middle Eastern spice mix. And then I serve it with black lentils that are also warm spiced and onions. And it's a dish that can be left vegan, but I also like it with a dollop of yogurt, and then I shower it with a bunch of herbs and I believe dried figs. I've done it with dates, dried figs. I've added seeds. So
I've made that dish. I think it's really hearty for being mm-hmm. very vegetable-y. Mm-hmm. I also do love the yogurt. I think it really brings something special to mm-hmm. it. And I can imagine, I just made it at home for me and Dan, but I can imagine people really diving into something like that, whether they were a vegetarian or not at a potluck. So you include a lot of potluck wisdom in this book. And as I was reading it, I was wondering, how did Kristen come upon this wisdom? Have you ever had things go wrong in potlucks in your life? Have you ever had any disasters or mishaps?
I'm sure I have. I think I will say just watching my mom entertain, she was really good at having everything like very organized in advance. So once people came, she still worked and hosted, but it wasn't, she was able to enjoy the party. So some of it I probably learned by osmosis. And then I think writing a lot of features about entertaining, I absorbed. I can't think of any particular potluck disasters.
Maybe that's because you came to the practice with all of that organization you learned from your mom.
I guess so, yeah.
With potlucks, as in many other things in life, organization saves the day.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us today. We really appreciated having you. And Kristen's book, Modern Potluck, is available wherever books are sold.
Thank you.
Okay, Joy. So, grapes are in the market now. Do you cook with grapes ever?
Okay, I do sometimes cook with grapes.
Uh-huh.
But when you say at the market, do you mean local grapes?
Yes.
Where are you getting local grapes?
So they show up at the farmer's market. You can also do you pick out at Mood's Farm Market in New Jersey.
Here at the Rittenhouse Farmer's Market.
Yeah. Beechwood often, Beechwood Orchards often brings fresh grapes to the market.
Do they bring leaves too, just out of curiosity?
They don't, but you can ask for them if you want them.
I do cook with grapes, but also almost more grape really? Leaves. And I always get, you know, the jarred ones, which are okay, but I've always heard fresh ones are better.
They are, and actually grape leaves are great too. We talked about crispy pickles earlier,
right?
But they have they're tannic, and so they add they sort of help firm up cucumbers when you're pickling them.
So what are your how do you cook with grapes?
Well, I often will pickle them because, you know, a sweet tangy brine with grapes is delicious as an additive for, like, if you're having cheese or some sort of cured meat or something like that, a pickled grape is really good. But I also like to roast them.
Me too.
So they get sort of caramelized. And then I also, you know, make a homemade Concord grape jam. Now I'm a grape jam person rather than a grape jelly. Because jelly, you know, you're extracting all the juice and then you're combining it with sugar. Whereas jam, I use a food mill, mm-hmm. one of my favorite kitchen tools. And I cook them down with the seeds and the skins. And then I fit the food mill with its finest screen and push them through. And then combine them with a little sugar or honey and cook them down. And it turns out to be this really, it is the grapiest grape tasting thing you've ever made.
Sounds good.
It's so good. You know, you thought you liked a peanut butter sandwich with strawberry jam.
I can't imagine that there's anything that I would like more. I know you're going to tell me I would.
But I think you'd like a grape jam addition just as much, at least.
I mean, I trust you.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe, but I do trust you.
It's pretty delicious.
I'm probably not going to make it.
Well, if I make some this year, I'll make sure you get some.
Okay.
But no, it is fun. It is fun to work with local grapes.
The thing that I've been doing with grapes the past couple months that I love is cooking them with sausages and balsamic vinegar.
Ooh.
It's just really, oh there's something God. About that sweet, tart, meaty combo that is.
That sounds amazing.
Quite tasty.
They must get really syrupy.
The whole thing does have a thicker, the sauce is a little bit thick. The grapes, they break down somewhat, but they're still hold their shape somewhat as well. And it's just like a real concentrated, sweet flavor that complements the pork really well.
And are you using red grapes or green grapes? Mm-hmm. Red grapes.
Like cheapo.
Yeah. Oh, God. It sounds really good.
Grapes. I bet it would be even better with local grapes. Are the local grapes green or red?
You can get some of each. Often they're green, but you can get local Concord grapes, and they're that sort of syrupy, rich red grapes. They do have seeds, which is the problem for roasting.
Oh, true. Yeah.
But
not a problem if you're putting them through a food mill.
Exactly.
Right. Cool.
Yeah. So, you know, if you see grapes at your farmer's market, make sure to get them because they are a seasonal, local, delicious treat, and you should try them while you can.
Well, I think that about does it for this week's installment of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing our music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, please make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. You sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out all our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.